5. The Inexhaustible Wisdom of the Sermon on the Mount. In this final chapter, I will address topics on the Sermon on the Mount and esoteric Christianity that have not been discussed earlier. I will continue using Pekka Ervast's book on the Sermon on the Mount because it opens avenues for thought and challenges us to see new and easily ignorable aspects of the sermon. The most important sermon in Christianity is problematic in many respects. First, it is tied to its own time, addressed to people living in a very different social and cultural reality than ours. Second, it is open to many interpretations. One can easily look for loopholes. Its ethics is hard both to understand and to apply in everyday life. The Sermon on the Mount should be understood as a whole. If I were able to view this text with the eyes of the Holy Ghost, I could see it as a whole. However, I'm just an ordinary person, so I'll have to be content with a method of science, analyzing the text in parts. This kind of study is helped by intuition and the associations inspired by this sermon. In this way, one can approach it as new in different phases of life and find fresh perspectives that are relevant to current situations. These observations can be a source of joy if their insights can help us to see a new attitude or action we haven't tried before. The resounding gong and music of the spheres. We grow and gradually learn to trust in love through many incarnations and many crises. Having eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we started in the school of painful efforts. Here, in the world of polarities, conflicts, and separateness, we learn to resolve the polarities and to find the unity behind them. Jesus teaches his followers using paradoxes in which the opposites seem to transform into each other. We face a question: does paradoxical thinking enable human consciousness to evolve toward unity? When we meet people who have started to purify their minds, we notice that they have found the key to contradictions in paradoxes. They see beauty in and through ugliness. They understand that suffering is a blessing in disguise. They believe that by giving away and giving up before they must, they can have everything. They see that being sensitive takes the greatest courage. They treat malefactors with compassion and love, because they know that in the end there is no other solution. They understand that true love is born and becomes stronger by giving. It doesn't ask what's in it for me. When people start to see paradoxes, they learn that there is a microcosm within that is like the macrocosm without. As above, so below. Death is inevitable, but it is not a disaster. It is a gate to a new life. A new opportunity emerges out of the crisis. There are paradoxes even in the highest stages of spiritual evolution. In a high degree initiation drama, the sword is not for killing or violence. Instead, one learns how to point it toward one's own heart. Turning the other cheek is just the beginning of this initiation. We change our weakness into strength and asset by delving deep in the reasons causing the weakness. Darkness is necessary so that we can understand and see light. Erik Blomberg says it beautifully in his poem, quote, "Don't be afraid of the darkness. That's when the light is lit. You cannot see the stars before the dark sets in. Don't fear the darkness. It is a womb of light. Don't fear the darkness. It is a condition for light. You also have a black iris in your eye. Only through the darkness can light be seen." End of quote. Love raises us above polarities. As St. Paul says, "If I speak in the tongues of men or angels, but I do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal." 1 Corinthians 13:1. There is a Finnish saying about a rattle that comes out of empty barrels. We hear a lot of resounding gongs and clanging cymbals around us, and I can hear this noise inside myself as well. There is too much loveless effort and struggle in the world. How then do we make the gong ring? How do we tune the clanging cymbal so that it resounds with love? These questions create further questions. How does one learn to love? We learn to love everywhere in all our encounters. We teach it to each other all the time. If you decide to put your love to the test, if you decide not to resist evil, or if you decide to approach a person with love, even if you dislike him or consider him an enemy, your decision will be heard. And you will find yourself in situations where you can test your ability to keep your resolution. You will be tested for your words. If you are serious but don't yet have faith, give it a try and see what happens. Learning to love takes courage. It is always about putting yourself on the line. Every time we earnestly try to talk about love, act lovingly, or experience love in art, we have to reveal what is most vulnerable in us. We give up all the structures we have set up to protect us. Possibly we will be hurt in these situations where we have opened ourselves. However, we shouldn't keep records of wrongs. We should persistently prepare for a new attempt, remembering that giving, not receiving, is the most important thing in love. Sometimes we may lose our strength and energy, our courage fails us, and it feels as if we have failed, even when we have tried our very best. Again, determination is invaluable. Concentration on what is essential, a new attempt, and a trust that life will prevail. The verse, "Thy will be done," will gain prominence within us. We may struggle with faith, but this faith is not just believing that something is true. It is action guided by conscious will, and love is its essential core. We will always face situations in which our faith, and our faith in love, is on trial. Not resisting evil, learning to understand its logic, and learning to love are all the same practice with the same aim: to ignite the divine spark that everyone, Christian or not, carries within. It is the highest self, the Christ within, as the Theosophists say. When this state is open, the person is able to feel the greatest love that can be felt on earth. This union is described as nirvana, moksha, or samadhi. Western mystics and alchemists talk about the cosmic or mystic wedding, which is a great festival of love. I submit that people in all religions aspire to have contact with their higher selves. A truth seeker who enters the path of purification and begins to study the basics of expanding love may encounter moments of smaller or greater cosmic love. These will give the seeker more understanding, trust, and strength. Understanding is an important outcome of learning to love. Trust fosters faith, which will be transformed into knowledge on the path of purification. Conscious search and struggle can begin in the midst of everyday life, on the playground or in the mall, while we are learning love with those who are closest to us. There is no need to be isolated from humanity when reaching for cosmic consciousness. Jesus Christ was such a great spiritual teacher because he could bring a model of divine love to us so brightly in his life and teachings. He brought it into everyday life where the common people live. He reached out to outcasts, prostitutes, thieves, despised, and supposedly useless people. The path of purification is a start. Proceeding on this path will produce a change in our love life, which is connected to sexuality. Once a man asked, "What shall we do when everyone is a saint? Where is all the fun then? How do humans carry on?" It was a good question. Evolving always means that something must be left behind to make room for something new. Of course, one must avoid any kind of coercion. One cannot force oneself to enter the spiritual path, which is about giving away, forgiving, and loving unselfishly. Love lives in the atmosphere of freedom. Coercion will always produce a counteraction. One can outgrow sexuality when there is no satisfaction in it anymore. We have to see that experiences of spiritual love have more to offer than those of physical love. If we don't have this faith, there is no incentive to try. Motivation will grow by studying speeches and writings of the Elder Brothers, who reveal their own experiences with cosmic love. One answer to the questions posed by the man above is that when one has become a saint, one can do whatever one likes. Hermann Hesse writes that, quote, "We must prepare for parting and leave-taking, or else remain a slave of permanence," end of quote. When the old practice doesn't work anymore, it's natural to start something new. Pekka Ervast tells us something about our distant future as male and female. In his book, The Gospel According to John, which has not been translated into English, he writes, quote, "Reaching eternal life is the longest and most arduous path. It is a great secret, which will be reached only by transforming the sexual force fully into inner spiritual force. Creating new life takes place in this visible world. However, the condition for creating life is love, which manifests itself in two hearts beating in the same rhythm. We as human beings are here to learn the lesson of life and love so that we will ascend back to spiritual heights. We have learned how a heart meets the other heart and that we create new life in their union. We have to learn to love by looking each other in the eye and then create new life. It is a wonderful effort to learn to love and create new life by looking in the eyes. It demands wondrous purity to do so, and it takes great effort before the human being becomes such an angel knight that he just looks the other person in the eye and loves that way, not more intimately." End of quote. I am convinced that we are on our way toward greater kinship, greater brotherhood, and greater unity. At this point in history, I'd say that we're playing in an orchestra with only solo instruments, resounding gongs, clanging cymbals, and empty barrels. Occasionally, we will have a visiting artist, someone who teaches us to play in a way that deeply touches our hearts. There are masters, such as Jesus Christ, St. Francis of Assisi, and the Finnish hero and demigod Wainamoinen, who play so divinely that they attune us to the great song. They all have listened to the music of the spheres, which can rarely be heard here on earth. We aren't able to hear this music, although it is everywhere. Only the few who have practiced and attuned themselves can hear it. I recall a scene related to this topic from the Soviet director Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker, which is one of the greatest movie experiences I've ever had. A trio consisting of a scientist, an author, and a guide have returned from their expedition to an unknown region after sharing a joint spiritual experience. Stalker returns to his dark shack, his bitterly nagging spouse, and his crippled daughter in the vicinity of atomic power plants overshadowing polluted shores. The only consolation is a ramshackle radio tepidly playing the great finale of Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode to Joy. For me, this altered St. Paul's words, "For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face," 1 Corinthians 13:12, into, "For now we hear only from a ramshackle radio, then we shall hear living music." It is we who chime the living music. We must start training with resounding gongs, clanging cymbals, and empty barrels in order to tune them for playing the music of the spheres. The universal music, as described by the great composers or initiates such as Plato. This is about tuning the instrument of each and every one of us. The instrument is us. It must be kept in good shape, and it must be loved, because this instrument is unique in the cosmos. It has to be tuned to play as purely as possible. It has to be tuned with love and for love. Otherwise, there will be no harmony. All this is possible. The band of the universe is waiting for new players, who are slowly graduating from the Music Academy of Telos. There is room for everyone in the band of the spheres. We all will eventually play in that band, and the jams will be heavenly. The salt of the earth and the light of the world. After starting with the Beatitudes, Jesus' sermon continues as follows. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Matthew 5:13. In this passage, Jesus encourages and supports his disciples. What is the salt of the earth? 2 millennia ago, salt was a valuable substance. It was sought in the ground, dug up, and purified. It was a well-guarded treasure. Salt is used to preserve food from spoiling. One such food is bread, which we have seen Jesus talks about in the Lord's Prayer, referring both to material bread and to spiritual bread, that is, food for the Spirit. Jesus also reminds us that man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God, Matthew 4:4. Jesus needs the salt of the earth, that is, his followers and disciples, to preserve spiritual bread, which comes from the mouth of God. Salt is a substance that serves best when it's used for the right purpose, to preserve supersubstantial spiritual bread through the ages. It is also possible to think of the salt of the earth as a powerful flavoring, which makes earthly life more flavorful. It turns dull life into something delicious and enjoyable. Supersubstantial bread, combined with the salt of the earth, makes life good. Ervast approaches this topic from another perspective and talks about Attic salt, which refers to subtle wit. Ervast notes that the Latin word for salt is sal, which can also mean intelligence or sharpness of mind. Hence, it is possible to interpret Jesus' words on salt as saying, you are the intelligence of the world. Ervast, elaborating on this thought, says, quote, Jesus' followers are far from being simple, kind, but stupid. They are, on the contrary, the most reasonable and acutely intelligent among men. But their intelligence does not stultify or kill other people's intellect. It is no noisy fireworks. It animates, it cuts to the quick, it lends power and savor to the soul's nourishment. It is the uniting link between the higher and the lower self. It brings heaven on earth, light into darkness. End of quote. Salt losing its saltiness means losing one's strength or skill through neglect or lack of practice. Then it is like a candle that has been lit but veiled. Jesus talks about this in the following way. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. Matthew 5:14-15. What is the light of the world? It seems to be more than the salt of the earth. It is something that affects the whole universe. The sun is the source of light in our world. God causes the sun to shine for the evil and the good alike, Matthew 5:45. The source of life resides in the sun. It is the source of all plant-based food on earth. From the occult point of view, the sun is the spiritual center of our planetary system, an immense alliance of intellect and love, which makes our existence possible. Jesus' reference to the light of the world reminds us of sayings on light in other parts of the New Testament. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John 1:5. Attic salt is a symbol for intellect in the same way that light is. one can talk about the light of reason as well. However, there is also a dimension of love related to the idea of light. The light of the world is not just cold reason. It's also the light of love, wisdom, and truth. When Jesus calls his disciples the light of the world and the salt of the earth, he is charging them and his other followers with a huge task of advancement as well as with responsibility, foreshadowed by enormous spiritual visions for the light bearers. Jesus concludes this part with the following words: "In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Matthew 5:14. He reminds us that praise belongs only to the Father. There is no need for the disciple to look for kudos or praise. Jesus returns to this topic later when he talks about good deeds and fasting. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets to be honored by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. Matthew 6:1-2. Great tasks and responsibilities are always accompanied by the temptation of pride. A person who advances and receives the light of spirit and spiritual powers can explain things correctly and wisely. Her efforts have enabled her to receive knowledge and abilities that other people marvel at and envy. At this point, the danger looms near. The disciple must always take great care to remember that all wisdom, faculty, and spiritual skills have been given to her for more adept service and the ability to love her fellow humans. If we have the faintest idea of this service, we realize that there can be no swaggering. Jesus adds, "Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Matthew 6:4. He gives the same advice about prayer. "But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father, who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Matthew 6:6. The disciple's inner spiritual life, prayer, and fasting will be reflected in his external life. The question is always about motives. Why do we follow various spiritual practices? What are our aims? What are we trying to achieve? We ask these questions from ourselves, and these questions are asked of us. I would say that right meditation and prayer create an inner consciousness which guides external behavior in such a way that there is no need to constantly question one's motives. Jesus goes on to say, "When you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what the right hand is doing." Matthew 6:3. How is this possible? It is possible when our consciousness is so deep and high that it has penetrated our reflexes and gone into our body memory. We have become so competent in our service that the right inner motive and right thoughts will arise spontaneously. An old saying from Eastern philosophy states that what you think, you become. This is the ongoing process of the path of purification. When we think about Jesus' words, "Your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you," we could conclude that right action and love is a reward in itself. It creates comfort in the world, which is close to what we call happiness. People often want to get something and ask, "What's in it for me?" Ervost explains, quote, "That Jesus was thinking of no outer rewards, you will realize at once, but that he had in mind something which properly could be designated as reward is also plain. This reward is partly something inherent in the nature of things, partly something unexpected, something surprisingly superabundant." What might that be? What else but that peace of conscience, that joyousness and inner bliss, which in time follows upon the recognized position in the invisible kingdom of heaven. Keeping in mind these karmic results, as an Oriental would say, of our good deeds and endeavors, we do not wonder at all that Jesus spoke of rewards. Could you indeed imagine a greater boon, a greater heavenly recompense, a greater token of divine grace than the right of citizenship in the world of spirit, immortality, and eternal life? End of quote. Everything flows. After the Lord's Prayer, Jesus addresses our relationship with worldly treasures, mammon, generally what we call everyday worries. He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Matthew 6:19. Jesus teaches us that all we have received and will receive in life is merely a loan and a gift we have been given so that we can learn to give forward to those in need. Jesus urges us to give away whatever earthly possessions we have. This helps the flow of life. In a way, Jesus is a great prophet of recycling. St. Paul frames the same idea as follows. God loves a cheerful giver. 2 Corinthians 9:7. The motive and manner of giving are important. Someone who doesn't understand the importance of flow, of breathing in and out, constantly tries to stop the flow of life. They have a hard time comprehending that everything changes and flows, that this is a law of life. We try to stop the flow because we want to feel safe. We create blocks and dams to prevent the flow. We collect money and belongings, piling up possessions and goods. We want to prevent things from happening when it appears to be useful for us to do so. We believe that it's possible to freeze life so that we can enjoy something forever. It takes a very long time in each incarnation to remember that this is not correct. Life is advancement, evolution, constant change, and growth. What happens if we dam the stream of life? Life doesn't cease flowing even if we try to stop it. Life passes by and goes around us like water. Sometimes it snatches us into the foam, and it may take a long time before we come around. But perhaps this is quite rare. Usually, life respects our free will and lets us sit on top of our pile or money or possessions or keep our stagnant emotions and attitudes. At some point, however, we will wake up and ask why life has passed us by.
The flow of receiving and giving sustains the breath of life. By the usual mode of thinking, we only give something to someone with expectations of getting something back. We wonder what kind of service will come to us in return for being so good. We also do good deeds and services, expecting that people will be thankful to us and praise us. These attitudes can easily lead to clubs of mutual praise, where good deeds become goods for sale.
The law of flow in life works differently. Each truly good deed will beget new deeds, but the consequences will not immediately come back to us as favors. Instead, good deeds pass on forward in an expanding chain. The Finnish songwriter Juuso Leskinen told a story about a contagious yawn. What if it so happened that a yawn passed across the globe so that eventually we got back the yawn we initiated? According to one theory, yawning is due to lack of oxygen. Similarly, we could extend Leskinen's idea to cover good deeds, which foster the intake of spiritual oxygen. Unconditional love is the way spiritual life works. Love lives and breathes in the flow of life. When Jesus gave the commandment of love, he elaborated on it as follows. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? Matthew 5:46. Love is constrained in too small a circle. Those outside the circle become strangers, and brotherhood is not extended to them. I will cite a summary by my friend, yoga instructor Timo Mulyakangas, of Jesus' double commandment of love. Love the Lord your God with all your soul and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. This is a slightly shortened version of Luke 10:27. When we live in this world knowing this maxim, we realize that we are subjects of God's love, wherever we might be. We are loved all the time, no matter what we do. When we recognize this at some point, we start to think how we could respond to this love. It will dawn on us that the way to do it is to love God and other people. We love and serve God by loving and serving one another. This service will store up treasures in heaven for us, as Jesus puts it. That love will be our legacy in the world. In addition, it will build our heavenly life from the loving thoughts of the people who love us. When Jesus talks about mammon in the Sermon on the Mount, he urges his disciples to stop worrying about external matters and relax in a heavenly freedom from care. Worry will cease only when one has a strong trust and faith in life, which prevails even if one gives up worrying over external matters. Naturally, we avoid this piece of advice, explaining that, of course, we must take care of ourselves. It would be irresponsible not to do so. We come up with excuses because our faith is not strong enough. We retreat behind responsibility, although our real issue is the fact that we do not trust that life will prevail. However, we must take responsibility for one another. God will take responsibility for us. This is one aspect of the double commandment of love. The leap of faith here has troubled many who have thought about the process of letting go. Often, one has to be forced to the edge before one is ready to take the leap. On the edge, there are no other alternatives. Søren Kierkegaard wrote, "I would have perished had I not perished." One who has taken a leap of faith may say, "I would have fallen had I not jumped." I have also heard the following: most of us will sink, only few will dive. Jesus ends this passage by saying, "Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." Matthew 6:34. This short verse offers a lot to think about, and I have a feeling that it will become important for those who are looking for truth in our time. One must live now, not in tomorrow, which is uncertain, nor in yesterday, since it cannot be lived anymore. We must live now and make this moment into a continuous now. This point is related to what Pekka Ervast and Uno Pore, the former chairman of the Finnish Rosy Cross, used to say: "The kingdom of heaven will be won over by a sneak attack." Without thinking or fearing about the consequences, one must leap into this moment and take hold of the truth right now. Of course, a devil's advocate would see an invitation to irresponsibility here. One could take this as permission to live without any regard to future generations or the teachings of the past. Some of Jesus' maxims may be related to his teachings on treasures in heaven and our relationship with mammon. One such verse could be the following: "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Matthew 6:22-23. Ervast states that reason or intellect is the light in the body. When the reason is bright, the whole body is healthy. Purity in thoughts springs forth as a right way of life. I'm sure that Ervast is right in his interpretation, but this verse reminds me of the saying, "The eyes are the mirror of the soul." What happens inside us can be seen in our eyes. We cannot hide our thoughts when our eyes betray us. A disciple who has followed the path of purification and has had spiritual experiences will receive the powers Jesus is referring to. These powers affect other people by flowing through the eyes. That's why Jesus stresses the meaning of purity in thoughts and motives. In my opinion, this is related to the verses in which Jesus talks about his disciples as the light of the world. By the same token, this passage seems to be related to Jesus' warning on the false prophets at the end of the sermon. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Matthew 7:15-18. A false prophet is known by the lack of light in his body. The quality of his work is revealed by the fruit of his work. We must sharpen our powers and intellect to prevent us from following the wrong people. This warning seems very timely. The ethics in the Sermon on the Mount continue to be the proper yardstick. Jesus' teachings are not outdated. People generally have not started to follow them in the first place. On the other hand, we have to take care in following any prophets, that is, other people. It seems to be enough for Jesus if we search for the kingdom of God within us. Everything else will be given to us with it. At the end of the sermon, Jesus talks about his yoga as the narrow gate and the narrow road. He says thus, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate, and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." Matthew 7:13-14. There are many spiritual guides in the media whose teachings should be compared with those of Jesus. These are the rock, the enduring foundation, the law from which not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear. Miracle makers and different kinds of masters will come forward nowadays. But it is difficult to ignore the fact that we must make an effort ourselves. No cosmic angel, spiritual ray, or Maitreya will save us unless we want to be saved and are willing to do the needed work. Next, Jesus gives his well-known parable about building on the rock. "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rains came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock." Matthew 7:24-25. Jesus' teaching, his new ethics, is seen as a universal foundation in theosophy. There will be many teachers, new prophets, novel spiritual systems. All these can be compared with this bedrock. It is the measure of human development. Toward the end of his sermon, Jesus gives a promise related to what was said earlier. "Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him?" Matthew 7:9-11. These verses promise to deliver help for anyone who asks for it. Asking, begging, and praying are signs of faith. Although they are not signs of its strength, they are nevertheless signs of faith. They tell about our relationship with the divine. I know people wiser than me who often wonder, "Why don't you ask?" The experience teaches us that it is indeed wise to ask. Usually we ask other people, but we don't know how to ask our inner self. Yet the wise continually remind us that all wisdom is inside the human being. Our problem is that we have doubts in trusting ourselves our inner intuition, our inner divinity. When we look around, we soon notice that not many people have asked, searched, or knocked seriously enough. How many have really knocked on the door of the kingdom asking for entrance? Instead, don't we simply go where other people are going? We don't have the courage to ask for more light in our lives, because it would expose the unclean corners within us. Instead of daring to heal, don't we just take a medicine that expels the symptoms? What would happen if the door were opened for the one who knocks? People for whom the door has been opened, that is, who have experienced expanded consciousness, are usually cautious about sharing their experiences. They may sometimes refer to these experiences and may say something related to them, but they seldom reveal the actual experience. Words fail us because the enlightenment experience is very personal in nature and arises directly from the life of the experiencer. To sum up, the goal in the yoga of Jesus is to achieve union with a higher state of consciousness. This spiritual system, which is given to us by our master, expands the mind and consciousness by teaching a practice of thinking and living in ways this book has attempted to discuss. It is a safe path of advancement, and it opens pathways to the ultimate spiritual goals, which are pursued by people all over the world. However, because of a lack of certainty, most of us prefer to be asleep. Moreover, taking a leap of faith is fearsome, and waking up necessarily requires change, which is frightening as well. In an old Zen story, a student has studied wisdom at the feet of his master for a long time. One day he is tired and frustrated and asks, "Master, tell me, is there anything I could do to achieve enlightenment?" The master answers, "My student, you can influence enlightenment as much as you can have influence on the sun rising every day." The student, becoming even more frustrated, asks, "So why does all this studying and practice go on and on?" The master replies, "So that you can be awake when the sun rises." This is the end of the Yoga of Jesus. The reader was Richard Smalley.